Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for tuning in to Tripod Talk Radio, where we're spreading the word that it's better to hop on three legs than limp on four. Hosted by Jim and Renee and Wyatt Ray of the Tripods Blogs community at tripods.com, Jerry's place for canine amputees and their people.
Hello, and thank you for listening. This is Tripod Talk Radio, and today is Tuesday, December 8th, 2015. Today, we are honored to have Arlene Weintraub here to discuss cancer in pets and humans. Specifically, we'll talk about the importance of comparative oncology and clinical trials for canine cancer treatments. Arlene is an experienced science journalist and author of the new book, Heal: The Vital Role of Dogs in the Search for Cancer Cures. For more information, please visit healdogsandcancer.com and find our book review at amazon.tripods.com. We have a lot to discuss about how dogs are helping us find a cure for cancer. So let's get started. Welcome to the show, and thanks for joining us, Arlene.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, Arlene, it's Renee here, and we're so excited to have you as our guest because we just finished reading your book, and we are just thrilled that you wrote such an incredible informational piece about comparative oncology, which intimidates a lot of people just to even hear those words put together. So we're glad you're here today so you can explain everything that you learned and why people need to read this book. So thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
Sure. Well, for folks that haven't read the introduction about the book, Arlene wrote this after her sister Beth passed away from gastric cancer. And I just want to say I'm so sorry. I just can't even imagine what that was like for you. And you know, we in our community, we know about cancer. We are touched by it every single day. And we know how hard it must have been for you to write the book while you were coping with your own loss there. And I'm curious, how did you even find the strength to start writing something like this? Was there someone or something that kept you inspired and going? Did you ever want to quit while you were writing it? It's such a huge topic. I'd love to hear how you approached it.
Well, actually, I learned about the topic during the year that my sister was fighting her cancer. I was working on staff at Business Week magazine as a science writer, and these two veterinarians from Texas A&M showed up and basically opened my eyes to this topic of comparative oncology. I knew that dogs get cancer, but I had no idea they get the same cancers that people get, and that they could actually help to find new therapies for cancer. And I come from a family of dog lovers. You know, the dogs started arriving before I did. And I was really captivated by the topic. And it's difficult to be sad around dogs. So that always kept me going.
And do you have a dog of your own right now?
Yes, I have a terrier mix. Her name is Molly. Luckily, I've never had a cancer experience in any dog, but yeah.
Wow. Well, I'm so happy that you have a great, healthy dog there. That's awesome. And with a topic like this, I mean, it's you're a science writer by background. I'm just so impressed at how you managed to distill everything down so that lay people like me who don't have a science background can understand it. I literally read your book in about a week, and I thought it was going to take me a lot longer. So I really just want to encourage people to pick up a copy of this because you're going to love it. She has so many great stories in there and examples of how comparative oncology is helping. I would love for you to explain the basics of comparative oncology before we dive further into this. Tell me about what is it, who's doing it, and why.
Okay, well, the basic idea behind comparative oncology is that dogs get many of the same cancers that people get, including melanoma, breast cancer, lymphoma, gastric cancer, which is what my sister had, and several other types of brain cancer. And they are actually much better models for the disease than rodents are. As you probably know, mice and rats are very commonly used in medical research to help develop new therapies. But they don't get cancer naturally. They don't live in our environment. It's a very artificial situation. So in comparative oncology, veterinarians and scientists who study human oncology work together to research new therapies that hopefully will end up working in both dogs and people, and maybe even cats.
Now, when you use the words research and dogs in the same sentence, you know, a lot of people's red flag goes up. And I know that the first time I heard that, too, when our dog Jerry was going through cancer, and somebody mentioned clinical trials, we just said, well, why would we do that? Oh, my gosh, they're not going to test on my dog. Tell me what, you know, that's such a gut reaction for most people. Why shouldn't we feel that way when we're talking about this subject?
Right. Well, as I say at the beginning of the book, this is not animal research. These aren't dogs that live in labs and are given cancer and then given these sort of unproven therapies to see what happens. For the most part, these are clinical trials. They happen in veterinary clinics, and they're very similar to human trials in that they're designed for patients to get access to cutting-edge therapies. And first and foremost, the idea is to help the patient, possibly cure the patient. And oftentimes there are patients that have no other options. And so I emphasize in the book that it's ethically, it's very different from animal research because these are people's family members. And it's just like enrolling a child in a clinical trial or enrolling yourself in a clinical trial. It's designed to help the patient.
And in your book, you talk to so many of those pet parents about their dogs and cats who were in these clinical trials. And I would love to hear some examples of some of the people that you talked to. Can you share some of the experiences that you wrote about in the book?
Sure. Well, one of my favorites, actually, the dog is no longer living, but it's still one of my favorite anecdotes, is a dog, a Labrador retriever named Emmy, who was treated at Colorado State University. She had bone cancer in one of her legs and went through amputation. And she also participated in a clinical trial of a type of gene therapy. This is a very exciting area of research in many diseases. And the idea is basically to insert a gene into the body that would churn out a therapeutic protein that may shrink cancer. And so she did very well in this trial. She actually gained 3 years of life and ended up dying of old age. And
wow.
Her owner was a survivor of breast cancer. So they had a very special bond. And, of course, you know, the owner was initially not very sure about enrolling her dog in the trial or even treating her dog with traditional chemotherapy, which she also had because chemo is a terrible experience for people and there's a natural reluctance. But in the end, she obviously was very happy she did it.
I love that Emmy beat those odds, and I mean 3 years is, you know, it's rare. We've seen it happen in our community. We've seen dogs go 5 years after osteosarcoma. They surprise us, and I would love for there to be more dogs like Emmy who passed away from something other than the cancer. So it's so awesome that she had this therapy. gene therapy is a little confusing to me. So can you elaborate a little bit more on that and tell us a little bit more about what you learned?
Sure. Well, in some diseases, gene therapy is being looked at as a way to actually replace a faulty gene. In the case of cancer, though, what you do is you basically insert a new gene into the body, and all genes produce proteins, and proteins can be very therapeutic. So the idea behind this therapy that was tested at Colorado State was to insert a therapeutic gene in the body, and it would turn out this protein that's essentially an anti-cancer agent. So it's basically reprogramming the body to fight the cancer.
And they create these new genes in a lab situation and then put them in the body, or are they from another source, or where do they come from?
Yes, they're inspired by genes that we have naturally in our body, and they're engineered and then inserted. But it's kind of an early stage idea in cancer, and there's a lot of research going on right now.
That's really exciting. I mean, can you imagine just, you know, here, take this gene and put it inside you, and it's gone. Goodbye, cancer. That'd be like, wow. Now, with all of the pet parents that you talked to, did you talk to any that had regrets about doing the clinical trials, or what were some of the downsides that they might have shared with you?
Well, it's interesting. None of them had regrets. Obviously, some of the dogs did not respond well and were moved to other therapies or taken out of the trials or even euthanized. And still, none of the pet parents had any regrets because they felt that they were contributing to knowledge that could ultimately help other pets in the future and possibly even people. And that was also very inspiring. You asked me earlier what was my source of inspiration. Well, you know, that kind of feedback was really inspiring. And very early in my research process, I met actually two biologists who were working in Silicon Valley. And their dog was quite young, 6 or 7, and she came down with multiple myeloma and participated in one of these trials and ended up gaining 2 years of life. So she still died fairly young, but they said to me, we believe in science. And I kept hearing that as I continued to do my research, and it was very inspiring.
I would have to say that after reading your book and through my own experience with talking to oncology veterinarians and researchers and things, my belief in science has definitely evolved as well. When our dog Jerry was going through osteosarcoma, we opted out of chemo, and this was back in 2006. But we just, you know, we had these images of him losing his fur and being sick, and, you know, just like exactly what happens with humans. And the more I see the way oncologists and these clinical trials are able to manage the symptoms and the way they put quality of life first for these animals is just amazing. It's awesome to see, and I hope I never have to go through that again with a dog. But if I do, you know, I would give it some serious thought and consider, give it more consideration than I did last time. Things have changed even in the last 10 years. They've changed so much, and so exciting to read all of these examples that you share in the book. I love the way you divided up the book into chapters about different types of cancer. And as you know, our community deals with bone cancer and mast cell cancers quite a bit. So can you share some of what you learned, some of the experimental treatments that scientists are working on right now for bone cancer and mast cell cancers?
Right. Well, bone cancer, as you know, osteosarcoma, is very similar in dogs and in children. And so comparative oncology is considered particularly important for finding new osteosarcoma cures for children. Humans don't do nearly as well with amputation as dogs do, because of course dogs have four legs and tend to do very well on three. But I wrote about one particular drug called MTPPE. That's an abbreviation for a very long scientific name, and actually spoke to a young woman who was cured by this drug in a clinical trial involving children. And then it went through a regulatory process that was just crazy and never got approved in the United States. And it was especially effective in dogs. And I've heard that there are ongoing efforts to get it approved in the U.S. Obviously, veterinarians and doctors who treat people really want to get a hold of this drug. So that was a particularly interesting example. The gene therapy was really interesting. And of course, there are also new surgical techniques in osteosarcoma that are being tried in dogs, including techniques for removing the tumor without needing amputation, improved techniques for being able to visualize the tumors, get them to literally light up so that surgeons do a better job of removing all the cancer cells. So that's all very exciting research. Mast cell tumors are somewhat different. They can't be often cured with surgery if they haven't spread. It's when they spread where new therapies are needed. And actually, the first comparative oncology trial that I wrote about resulted in Palladia, which was the first cancer treatment approved just for dogs. And that is an interesting drug. It's part of a class of drugs called tyrosine kinase inhibitors, which are now very widely used in people as well. And there's still ongoing research in that class of drugs.
I love the way the drug names just roll off your tongue. you are so well acquainted with them. I know a lot of us at Tripods know what Palladia is, it's just now something that people whose dogs have bone cancer are using, typically when metastasis happens. But for mast cell, people have been talking about it for quite a while, and some people try it, and it works for some dogs, and it just has these terrible side effects for others, so it's kind of a crapshoot. But I'm curious, in your research, did any of the oncologists and the researchers that you talked to, were they looking at causes for cancer, or are they more focused on treating it, or where's the real emphasis in all of their research?
The major emphasis is on treatment, but there's a school of thought out there that our pets can also be very valuable in studying the causes of cancer, particularly environmental cancer. And I include a chapter on cats in my book, which includes some research on things like secondhand smoke and its effect on cancer. There were a number of studies done in cats. As you know, cats groom themselves, and so they ingest things in the environment and are considered a very good model for the environmental risks that we all face. So there is a small research effort focused on trying to determine the causes of cancer. Also, I write about a study that you might have heard of. It's the Golden Retriever Lifetime Study, which was started by the Morris Animal Foundation.
We love Morris. We're huge fans of Morris at Tripods.
Right. So part of the purpose of that study is, you know, they're tracking several thousand golden retrievers over their lifetime. And part of the hope there is that there will be some themes that come out about the possible causes of cancer and other diseases that affect golden retrievers.
That's good to know. It's really, really good to know that they're approaching that angle as well. I would love to talk more about cats, because we do have quite a few cat members who have joined us, and cats have been, it's crazy. There's a few cats who've joined us because of osteosarcoma, which is, ask any oncologist and they'll say, wow, that's just rare. That never happens. But it happens. They join us. We see them. These cats lose their leg to this disease they're not supposed to get. And when I was reading your book, it blew my mind when you wrote about how cats who have been around secondhand smoke have been shown to ingest the toxins from the smoke. That is incredible. Can you tell me more about what you learned about cats and cancer and these clinical trials and things?
Yes. Well, in addition to looking at environmental risks, and there are ongoing studies in that area, cats are considered a particularly good model for some types of cancer. And the number one cancer is triple negative breast cancer, which is very similar to mammary cancer in cats. This is the hardest type of breast cancer to treat, and there's a huge demand for new therapies for both people and cats. And so there's a lot of research going on there. I also wrote about an interesting trial. I went to the University of Illinois, and I wrote about a trial that's being done with metformin, which is an approved diabetes drug that's used by millions of diabetes patients around the world. And observational studies have found that patients with diabetes on metformin have a very low risk of cancer. So now there's a tremendous amount of interest in finding out if metformin might also be used to treat cancer. And I went out to the University of Illinois and found out about a trial of metformin, met one of the cats in the trial, and it was only a 2-week trial, but she is still alive and managing her cancer quite well.
Oh, that's wonderful. That is wonderful. Do you find that that cat parents are willing to do clinical trials as dog parents? Is there a difference in how they approach it?
Unfortunately, there's a huge difference because cats are not great patients. And for any clinical trial, you have to be a fantastic patient. And you know, dogs will do anything for a treat. They're often very happy to go to the vet. Cats, it can be very difficult just to even get them in the carrier to get in the car to go to the vet. Fluffy, who was a cat that I met, was an exception to this. She was very social, very happy. Part of the trial involved actually having to stay in the veterinary clinic for a couple of days. She just was never got nervous like
wow.
The dogs, you know. So that's the kind of patient. That's the kind of patient you need, and they can be very difficult to find.
I would definitely say that based on the cat members who have blogged about their experiences. That's a one in a million cat there.
Mm-hmm.
But now, you know, one of the most shocking things I learned in your book is that there are millions of dollars out there for cancer research in humans and cancer therapies, and all of this money is out there. But when comparative oncology researchers go to apply for grants, they're often turned down. And that just, I went, whoa, what's going on here? Can you tell me why this is happening, and what can we do as advocates to change that?
Well, yeah, I was amazed by that, too. I asked that question everywhere I went. You know, I said, well, why can't you go to the Breast Cancer Foundation or this foundation or that foundation? They have millions of dollars, and they all get turned down quite often because the responses they get say things like, why would we fund research in dogs when we can do mouse trials? So there seems to be a lack of understanding out there, even in the scientific community, of the value of dogs as a model for cancer. And there's a lot of people out there that are trying to change that, but it's still difficult. And in my book, I list a number of foundations that are focused entirely on animal cancer or comparative oncology. And so I think one thing that everybody can do is to make donations to those causes, which I encourage in the book, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that's what's needed, is just more of a knowledge of the importance of using our pets in research and the advantages that this is going to offer, not just for people, but for veterinary medicine also.
I would definitely agree. I love the list of foundations that you put in your book, and you put Puppy App Foundation, of course, which is one of our favorites. We're a little biased because we know Luke personally, and we're there when he first took off on his 2,000-mile walk from Austin to Boston. He's an interesting guy, and we're just really in awe of what he's managed to do with Puppy App. So they're a great cause to rally behind. As far as donating to universities and things like that, what are some of the top universities that are leading the way in this field?
Well, there's actually a website where they are all consolidated. It's the Comparative Oncology Trials Consortium. It has a list of all of the colleges that participate in this. But some of the leaders are Colorado State University, which we talked about, the University of California, Davis, Ohio State University, and Texas A&M, which we talked about. But I really encourage dog owners who are facing cancer to call their closest veterinary school first to find out if they're participating in this research, because it's really spreading, it's growing pretty fast, and a lot of universities are now participating.
That's awesome to hear. I know, teaching hospitals are just amazing places, and the people who work there are They're really changing things for the better. So, we like to encourage people to check out their local institution if they're lucky enough to be near one. That first website that you mentioned, the Comparative Oncology, what was it called? The Comparative Oncology Foundation?
Yes, it's the Comparative Oncology Consortium. And hold on a minute. Yeah, the Comparative Oncology Trials Consortium. Yeah.
Do you happen to know the website address?
Yes, it's ccrod.cancer.gov. It's part of actually the National Cancer Institute, but people can also just search for Comparative Oncology Trials Consortium, and it's the first thing that comes up.
Awesome. We'll make sure that people do that, and we'll be sure to put that link in our upcoming post about your book. We're going to definitely get the word out so that it's under a lot of Christmas trees and on holiday tables this season, because people need to read this. It's really important that we educate everybody about this. I was shocked to read that human doctors are also kind of, I don't want to say clueless, but really, I mean, I've heard stories, and in your book you cite different examples of doctors, human doctors, who had no idea that dogs even get cancer. Were you surprised by that?
I was surprised, and one of the examples I give actually is of a Texas A&M veterinarian who did a seminar at MD Anderson, one of the top cancer centers in the world, and she got responses from doctors who said, "Get out of here, dogs get cancer?" You know, they just didn't even know that dogs get the disease, and so just by educating them, there ended up being a major research partnership between the two institutions. So you know, it's good that some veterinarians are getting out there and educating the medical community about this.
Awesome. Well, we will be there to help them. Now, we have under a minute, but I just wanted to ask you, you know, what can we do to be, I mean, it's hard to be hopeful sometimes when you're surrounded by cancer. We see it all the time. Do we have any kind of, I don't want to say, dare we hope for a cure? I mean, do you see that on the horizon based on what you learned and the people that you talked to? Do you see that in our future?
I do see it in the future. I think there's a lot that's still to be learned, but I do provide examples in the book of dogs who were cured, and that gave me a lot of hope. because, as you can imagine, I went through this terrible personal tragedy. I went into this book not believing in science at all and came out of it much more hopeful that there will be a cure.
That to hear. You're so close to the subject in so many ways, so it's very reassuring coming from you. Arlene, we really, really appreciate your time today. Everybody, please pick up a copy of her book. It's called Heal, The Vital Role of Dogs in the Search for Cancer Cures. And there is, who's the dog on the cover of your book, by the way? It's such a gorgeous little kit.
Yes, as I tell people, the dog is a lovely model who, as far as I know, does not have cancer, but I appreciate the dog's loveliness on my cover.
She was a good choice for the cover. So everybody, get a copy. And Arlene, thank you. Keep up the great work, and we hope to meet you in person someday and talk more about this.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time, Arlene. Listeners can learn more about your work at arleneweintraub.com and your new book at healdogsandcancer.com. And thank you for sending the book. Renee has published her review at amazon.tripods.com. Until next time, find more helpful pet cancer and amputation resources in the Tripods blogs, forums, and live chat at tripods.com.
Until next time on Tripod Talk Radio, learn more about canine amputation recovery and find the best gear for three-legged dogs at tripods.com. Ha ha ha!